Welcome to Imagine This Podcast, where we discuss, celebrate, and highlight all of the excellent and abundant arts and culture in Milwaukee.
We hope that after listening to the pod, you'll see and experience our city and the incredible, vibrant arts and culture community in a new way.
I'm David Lee.
And I'm Mac Antigua.
Is this going to be the third week in a row where we talk about summer in our opening banter?
That's right. I was just thinking about that. How do you lead into this? And so, like, okay, talking about the weather, talking about summer, it's hot, and we're not spending it outside as much. We're recording a podcast indoors.
Although it doesn't seem like it's going to storm today, so we don't have to worry about whether or not our internet's gonna bust out in the middle of an online meeting that where we have 25 people worried about whether or not they can continue to see the mural.
Dear listener, I hope wherever you are at whatever time you're listening, if it's not sunny outside, it's sunny in your heart, as it is for us, as we love recording the pod and love having you join us this week. And we got a great guest coming up later to talk about some really compelling work that's happening in Milwaukee, especially during this time of the uprising. And seeing new leadership emerge, but that's going to be after the break. Before that, we're just do a little story time, as we like to lead into it. We both, you emigrated to this country as a wee one, and I'm the child of immigrants. I was born in this country, but my parents had emigrated over, not together, they met in Chicago, but for a few years before I was born in Chicago. Which means we both navigated predominantly white spaces and institutions as we emerged.
In relatively diverse areas though, right? I mean, I grew up in San Francisco and you grew up in the suburbs of Chicago.
Not so, a diverse area.
Maybe not that diverse.
Southwest side, i.e. the destination of white flight. Like, you know, where I grew up with all the people that fled, you know, all the Catholics, right? All the Catholics that got out of the South Side, they moved three miles southwest to where I grew up. And my parents just wanted a yard. They didn't want to live in the city. They wanted a yard and good public schools. So it wasn't terribly diverse. But yeah, you grew up in San Francisco, much more diverse. However, that being said, I think we both navigated predominantly white spaces and institutions. And at times, having a sense of inclusion, I would say, afforded because of our own, the Asian model minority status, if you will, right? As evidenced by the many letters after our names, we've been accredited in these places, and not rocked the boat too much. But at the same time, at least I'll speak for myself, not totally feeling included, having a sense of outsiderness at the same time. However, I think arts and culture has sort of been a thread about navigating identity and navigating either that sense of belonging or lack of belonging. And so I wanted to start with stories about how did arts and culture, since this is an arts and culture pod, play a role for you?
Yeah, you know, I think in reflecting on this question, it was hard for me to separate the fact that I grew up in a predominantly Asian city in San Francisco. And also, I was reminded that when Crazy Rich Asians came out a couple summers ago, I went to see it, and my response to it was not the same as many other Asians, and I was wondering why that was. And it occurred to me that when I was growing up, my dad, who wanted to be a TV and film star in Hong Kong, was well on his way to doing that before he met my mom, and they had me and decided to move to America. Would take me to movies in Chinatown when I was growing up. And so, like, I grew up watching people like me, who looked like me, who spoke a language that I understood on a big silver screen. And so, I mean, particularly Bruce Lee, right? So, like, there was always, like, I grew up with a sort of a hero that looked like me and was the hero of the stories that he was in. And I think the tension for me was sort of growing up as we moved out of Chinatown and moved into sort of the more sort of middle-class neighborhoods of San Francisco, kind of seeing where the disconnects would happen, whereby it didn't seem like I was always in control of my own story, right? Or that the or that the story was not centered always on me, or people who look like me, but people who you know looked European and you know whatever it was. I remember this one thing. One thing that my mom has told me that I'll remember till the day I die. She said to me when I was very young. She said to me, you know, when people who come over here from Europe or Eastern Europe, over time, they'll lose their accents and they will be seen as white. Yeah. That'll never happen for you. And she told me that very, very young. no matter what you do, right, you will never fit in. And so despite the fact that I think arts and culture provided a way for me to see myself as the center of my own story, and gave me, I think, the intestinal fortitude to, you know, study film and theater and drama, to believe that I could actually make it in the industry.
How old were you when you got that advice? How old
were you when you? God, I'm trying to remember like the apartment we were living in, because that would have been my age. So I must have been, it must have been before middle school.
Wow. That's some pragmatic stuff, man.
My mom's nothing if not pragmatic.
So for me, I would say that I remember growing up in my house that my parents still spoke Bisayan, and I didn't. I unlearned it when I finally got to elementary school and did what your mom said, was try to lose that accent as soon as possible to stand out. Lost that language. However, that being said, my parents still spoke it at home. And that's probably where I learned how to read other ways of communicating, right? And tone and physical body language, when they would still speak to us in Bisayan. But my dad would listen to, I still remember he would listen to Filipino comedians, because I remember like these big records that he would put on. And I remember like the covers were very caricatured, because I think they had to make the covers look funny. You know, like, right. Remember like those old NBA championship shirts from the 80s where the people had the big heads, but the little bodies, right? Like similar genre, right? Like that, I still remember these album covers, I think. So I'm sure they're very broad comedians, but again, I would hear him listen to this. I would listen to him listening. It wasn't like directed to me listening. I don't remember the artist quite honestly. I it's unfortunate. I forgot that, just like the language I forgot, but I would hear the, rhythms of, again, comedy is comedy, right? Oh, that's the setup. That's the delivery. Right. That's the punchline. That's the reaction. Crowds are acting. And, you know, witnessing my dad hear like stuff that really resonated to him, because he was enjoying it too. And I think for me, not knowing the language was a bit of a barrier, but two, you know, not seeing that product. Like I wouldn't see that album when we'd go to record stores, right, in the mall, and you wouldn't see any of these products, wouldn't see any of these performers. The effect that it had on me was a sense of like, oh no, this isn't viable. Like this isn't meant. Yeah. I wish I was a little bit more defiant and been like, well, I'm going to fight this system and do it my way or whatever, you know, but it was the opposite. It was very much more pragmatic, like your mom, like, well, I guess not.
Were there places where your dad would go to get these albums?
I don't know. That being said, my dad would still go to cockfights up until recently. So there must be some sort of like here in the United States.
Underground Filipino. There must be
some sort of underground killer. Yeah, exactly. There's like, yes. We could have my dad, like I would tell stories of my dad and you'd think he's the most interesting man, but he will not tell any of those stories. Like I had to find out all these stories, you know, through other people. But anyway, that being said, it's another podcast. But I think for me, the effect of it was just sort of like, it existed, but it didn't exist where I lived.
Yeah.
Therefore it doesn't matter. And I think that was sort of the subtext that I carried, that like my culture didn't matter as much because it wasn't central.
I think that's
where the culture I grew up in.
You know? Right. And I think so we would always go to Chinatown. Right. And so like there'd be, as I grew up,
I didn't know
like,
where that town was. Yeah.
There would be places where I would see where you could buy things and buy movies and buy albums and songs and books that my parents loved and, you know, a whole bunch of folks loved. But it was not like a thing that I was like, that's not a world I want to be a part of. So like you, I got rid of my accent real fast, right? I wanted to be able, I wanted to buy the stuff at the mall down the street
or,
you know.
Stuff that's accessible. Exactly. And again, I don't, I think I might've told this story on the pod. I know this is a big story, my origin story. It was like, I was at Northwestern ready to be a theater major, and how they did it at Northwestern back in the 90s was when you declared your major as a young person, a freshman, you actually stood in line and you would, you know, wait, and then you get to the table, the eight by 10 table that somebody's sitting behind you, right? You'd sign up for your major. And I remember standing in the theater line for theater majors, right? And it was a long line. And that gave me so much time to think, like, what am I doing? You know, looking at all these white people in front of me, much more good looking, much more, I mean, I felt like they had it together, right? And as that line got closer and closer, I was like, there are no Filipino Hamlets. What am I doing? And then I jumped into communication studies, which is kind of like the generic, because I was in the school of speech, the generic, it was almost like general studies that like had very little requirements. Like I think it might have no math. So I just like jumped into comm studies right away. And, you know, it was sort of known as like the jock major. It actually turned out to be great for me. Like that was actually perfect for me. But I remember what it felt like to jump that line. And it wasn't because I just did, you know, again, some people will go like, darn it, damn the torpedoes, I'm going to do it. I was just much more, there's a reason why there are people that don't look like me there. And who am I to dare fight that, right? Like, I just didn't have it. And maybe that's a deal, right? If you don't have it there, how are you going to have it when you're auditioning? I get it. But, you know, I will say the epilogue to that is when the show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend on the CW came out a few years ago, I remember watching it and not only delighting of how amazing it was to see a musical, you know, happen, but there were so many Filipinos on the show. Yeah. And it was set in, I think, Temecula or something, part of California, where Filipino-ness, right? The Filipino country was centered.
Right.
Right. She was the outsider coming in. And so when you see the Thanksgiving episode, you see all these references to Phil-Am culture in it. I was just on the inside, like going crazy. Like, oh my God, we made it. Yeah. And it's sweet. That was a minor show. Like, no, I mean, it's a good show, but nobody's like, it's not Friends. It's not Sopranos. Like, nobody's talking about it. But I know for me at that age, when I was in my, you know, I think early 40s at the time, late 30s, it was like, it was amazing. It must've been like being seen on national TV for the first time.
Also interesting that the two cultural touchstones that we've named have crazy as the first word for Asians in it. I don't know what that's about.
That's got to mean something. Yeah, that's you tapping into your Clifton Strengths connections.
That's right. My connectedness.
Your connectedness.
Clifton Number four strength, everybody. Connectedness. Am I Micah right now, or are you Micah in the?
I don't have the sweater.
Strengths journey. That's right.
So yeah, for those of you listening, if you're into Clifton Strengths, we'll probably drop some of that since that's a thing. That's now a thing at the Imagine MK Room. Thank you, Lindsay Sheridan, host of Arts for Milwaukee. Either she's like a shadow ambassador and making like 10%, or she's just legit straight into, she's convert. Anyway, that being said, that's sort of our story time. And I think the notion of belonging and the notion of seeing yourself as young, seeing yourself in power, seeing someone like you in power really relates to the piece right here. Because again, arts and culture can be a bridge. It can be a code switcher. It could also be defiant dissent. Today we're excited to have someone from Leadership Igniting Transformation, just featured in the New York Times. Thank you very much. Look at me using outside media to justify how great things are. We already knew. One of the most innovating and exciting leadership orgs in Milwaukee. We've got Nyila Johnson. She's a cultural organizer there. She's a proud Black woman born and raised on the north side of Milwaukee and has worked at Lit as an organizer. They work with Black and Brown creatives and culture makers to create change in Milwaukee through the intersection of art and activism. Nyla graduated from Marquette. She'll talk about that in a bit. Began their career as an organizer and invested in their own music group and dance journey. Now at Lit, doing voter outreach and increasing voter turnout in Milwaukee Black Brown communities. They just had a real big success at Lit as they've been able to get MPS to divest $150,000 contract from MPD into actually mental health resources and Indigenous education. So they were ahead of it. they were on this tip before it got viral. So we're excited to have Naila after the break.
We will not be ignored. You will hear all our cries and our screams.
Naila, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Mac. Thanks for having me.
I think the last time I saw you in person was during the GMF conversations
that we had
with civic engagement and the arts.
Right? Yeah.
And you were part of on the table.
Thank you. I always felt so bad. I'm like, I know it has a brand. I know it has a name. I don't know it. Thanks for
saying like David on that. 10 years ago.
Yeah, it feels like, yeah, anything. Honestly, like February seems like 5 years ago. Anything in 2019 feels like previous life, past life.
Yeah, I thought, did I see you at the hashtag MKE movement art?
Yo, yeah, I saw you there.
Yeah, I was like, panel. I saw you in 2020. Yeah.
That also feels like 10 years ago.
Again, Naila, it snowed. Wasn't it snowing that day?
He's very bad.
That was at Walker's Point.
Yeah,
that's great. Yay. You know what's great podcast? Me and you talking about when we left. Hey, did I see you over at Zocalo eating like street corn, elotes? I thought you were there. All right, so
this is Mac's vision for creating like a cool kids club where he just gets to talk to our guests about the places they've been together.
Well, the thing about it is I'm old and lame. So anytime I get to say, yeah, I've been in the space with Naila Johnson, cultural organizer for Leaders Igniting Transformation, that increases my Q level, my Q score, and unfortunately breaks Naila's down.
You know what it is though, Naila? Like after we got to meet you in the fall, everybody on our team was like, hey, can we change my job title to cultural organizer? And
it's like, I want to do what Naila does.
Nope. That's awesome. No. It's a cool title. And a lot of people are like, what is that? It's the title is, it leaves a lot open to interpretation.
Yeah. Congrats. You did it. So Naila, thanks so much. Let's get to the present. Well, actually, we're not going to get to the present tense. We're going to do a little origin story with you. Talk about this. Can you share a story about how your own experience informs your current work as a cultural organizer, or might have foreshadowed it? You just didn't know at the time. But if we were all watching the movie of our life, we would all wink like, oh yeah, that was the moment.
It's really funny, actually. I was a student at Marquette University. It's actually where I got my degree from. I got my degree in health sciences, and I was an exercise physiology undergrad student. So completely science related, nothing social justice related, nothing creative art related. Mm-hmm. So it's actually really funny. But a lot of the majority of my time at Marquette University, I spent organizing, I spent creating different banners and images, flyers and things like that to let folks know what was going on. We ended up working together as a group of students. We decided not to become a student organization because you have to follow certain guidelines and regulations.
Foreshadowing.
Like, no, you cannot protest against the university, you know? So I was like, well, then we'll raise our own money and protest against the university, and we'll just be students who go here and our underground coalition. So we had hoodies made and t-shirts and things like that. The t-shirts ended up being worn for graduation over the gowns for graduation. So when people crossed the stage, there was that. But beforehand, we did hoodies for all of our marches. We created banners. We recreated and repainted an image of the seal to be inclusive and empowering towards Indigenous peoples. So a lot of times with art, or not even with art, but just with creating new policy and really being more inclusive, it's easy to call things out. But what's difficult is sometimes like having the solutions for them to have that change actually happen and be sustained. So we would call out the things we didn't like and then provide the solution for what we wanted to see in its place, how that seal, that image could still be used, but how to make it, frame it so it's more inclusive. So that was something that we did while at the university. During incoming freshman week, during freshman orientation week, we would create flyers and brochures about the harms and atrocities done to people of color at the university with images and stuff like that. and hand those out to the families at different orientation events. So that was what I would do. That was most of my all-nighters were organizing all-nighters, not homework all-nighters. I should have spent more time on homework. I probably would have, you know, had a 4.0. But I got a lot of experience that I needed. So what I lacked in formal education around organizing and cultural creativity, I made up for in experience, but actually being in community with people, Black and brown folks, educating myself on culture, not in the classroom, but in the community, and really just, you know, experiencing and being in those cultures myself as an African-American woman. I also was doing a lot of performing in college with a band I started called Triggered on Wells. Mm. So during my freshman year, I lived in a dorm on Wells Street. And, you know, we learned about words like being triggered by, you know, microaggressions. So we decided to call ourselves Triggered on Wells, and we would perform, and I would write all of the songs. And it would be, and I had some musicians who would write all the music, and we would perform it around the community and in Marquette about our experiences as people of color at a PWI, identity in Milwaukee, being Black, being Indigenous, and perform. And we also worked with NASA. So I was a part of Native American Student Association, where we started an event, an annual event called Earth Art and Hip Hop. So we would have cultural art and performances once a year on Earth Day. And so we that was somewhere we would always perform, that I was happy to be a part of the beginning of putting that together. So that's where the cultural organizing experience started. I used to do it all for free. You know.
Well, that's undergrad life, right? You're doing everything.
Yes.
Like, but it really sounds like, Nayila, that it might not have been, quote unquote, on the syllabus, but you were in the geographic in proximity to all this amazing stuff that's happening, and you dove into it. It might not have gotten, quote unquote, credit, but these are certainly down payments in terms of the work that you're doing now, right? In terms of these were the proving grounds for yourself, learning these early lessons about that. And I'm gonna dig a little deeper. Is there an early lesson that stands out for you that you still call upon today that you picked up in that world when you were emerging as an organizer? Is there one that's still, you know, either super true or one that, man, I got to keep learning this lesson over and over. Oh gosh.
I think the one lesson that I learned when it comes to organizing is sometimes you have to do it all within 24 hours. Sometimes you learn about something, it happens, and you have to organize and formulate a reaction around it right away. And figure out, okay, now what are the action steps? What do we want to see happen because of this? You know, you have to put all of that together within this 24-hour window of, you know, something happened today. We have to, you know, call it out and react tomorrow with numbers. And I think that's the hardest part, is sometimes it's, no matter how prepared you are or how much you've done this in the past, sometimes there's still that spontaneity moment that you have to have. You still have to just, you don't have a lot of time to plan. You have to have that experience, have those connections in the community to get those numbers, and then just react and call on people to be there. So I think that's a lesson that I keep experiencing over and over, because I'm a planner. I love to plan my life out. And that always just is, I'm like, nothing is too far planned in advance for me.
Oh, good. You know, Nayila, as you're speaking to me, you reminded me of, like, so how did we submit the letter to the grant, to the foundation, so that we want to apply for a grant, right? Like, it, to me, it goes against sort of the nonprofit foundation industrial complex vibe of, like, you need to have, and then you wouldn't go like, but I like to plan. Like, oh, if I say that, am I being rude or something? But I mean, what you're speaking to me is like, how do you be responsive, right, to what's needed in this moment? They don't always have 100-year outcomes necessarily, or 50-year outcomes that are like clean and clear, right? There's a sense of, again, improvisation and listening that you have to do as an organizer to identify the right direct action in the moment because the tension is high, as well as the urgency is there. And that's something you've had to learn, even though naturally you love to plan it out. You love to.
Yes.
Awesome. So I think what's been just sort of listening to you talk, I think like one thing that we've been talking a lot about internally over the last few weeks, obviously, is all of the incredible protest art that has just like sprung up, right, over the last few weeks in response to the uprising and everything else. So I'm curious in your, and we've been really trying to wrap our heads around this idea that, you know, throughout time, art has always been the tip of the spear for any social change. It's been the tip of the spear for any sort of social organizing, or in this context, cultural organizing. In your experience, why is that? Why is art such a powerful tool in bringing folks together and driving forward social change?
So honestly, I'm also an artist myself. So I'm just like, art is so everything. It's amazing. It's the closest we can be to a creator. You know what I mean? Like, we're also creating, just like the creator, in whichever sense you view the creator. So I just think that art really, people who create and use art, I honestly do believe vibrate on a completely different plane, a higher vibration, a higher frequency than folks who decide to live in a box and not try to operate outside of that. So I think that just for one, the more liberating we are in our work, the more liberation work we are, the more radical we are about our liberation work, the more we need to operate and think outside of that box. And I think creatives and artists and culture makers are the experts on that. And so I honestly believe, like, whenever someone's creating art or anything, it just moves people in a different way. And a lot of times you don't even have the words to describe it. And I think it's because that does have you feel those vibrations. And sometimes there aren't words for what that does to your mind and your spirit. So I think that it's also just hard to quantify and measure through data that type of change, like spiritual change, cultural change. That's really hard to measure. There's this quote that I heard by Philip Agnew where it says, art, data rarely changes people, but art always does. And it's like, that's true. And it's like, you can hear numbers and stuff, and it's for shock value a lot of times. Again, like with art, it causes like an emotion or a feeling inside. It allows you to reimagine things that you maybe couldn't put into words or reimagine without that visual representation or that audio representation. It's like, how do you describe a beat? You know, how do you describe a song or a sound? There's like certain words you can use that are commonly used that are to capture that, to categorize it, but still you can't actually, the English language, as far as I know, doesn't have the words to describe the thought, the feelings and the emotion and the vibrations of those sounds, you know? So I think that that's something that art captures and can really have a strong impact on shifting culture, that words alone, experience, hearing other people's experiences and stuff. So like storytelling, I think that that's a similar thing as well. Being able to hear someone's story, being able to hear it through poetry is another art form that I think really speaks to people more than data, you know, because you can see someone's, you can hear the emotion in their voice, you can see it on their face, you can, it kind of, especially depending on like how much EQ you have as far as like empathy, it can really impact you to hear what someone else is experiencing. So I think that that's just like another thing that makes art so powerful in every social movement.
That's great. So I guess, you know, transitioning a little bit into your work at Lit, Lit's vision, right, is to transform communities through a bold and proactive agenda led by young people that in our lifetime makes the movement to respect and value Black and brown lives matter a reality. Can you share with us a little bit, sort of building off of that, right? Like, can you share with us a little bit of how arts and culture plays a role, right, in making that a reality? And if you have any favorite examples about how Lit has sort of infused arts and culture into its work as an organization, obviously, in your work as a cultural organizer.
Yeah, so definitely like relating to that part about, you know, young Black and Brown people being able to, you know, share our stories and being able to really represent ourselves. So one of the things that we really want to do, or are trying to do at Lit, is empower and advocate for young people so that young people can also just be able to tell their own story and advocate for themselves, for the things that they want, the things that they need, the things that, you know, I feel like the older we get and the farther we stray from our youth, the more, again, we live in that box. The more we decide, you know.
What are you saying to me, Nayla, in this moment? What are you saying? Because I'm listening. My EQ is up. I feel like you're telling me something. I heard it. I hear it.
Just so you know, we went through this morning at our staff meeting. Mac is the oldest person in the Zoom room.
Message heard, Nayla. Truth, and I just want you to know, the note is heard. Carry on. Didn't mean to interrupt. I just want you to know, landed, and I heard it. Just go ahead. Carry on. Please carry on.
Like, definitely just as you get older, it's like when you think back to your youth, you're you're less worried about what people think. Mm-hmm. You're less embarrassed by your mistakes. You're more open to learning and knowing you don't know everything. Mm-hmm. Whereas as you get older and like decide to leave your, you know, start thinking less of young people, you start devaluing their thoughts and their feelings, and you start thinking that young people don't know how to advocate for themselves. And it's like, we all forget that we all were at one time young people, and I'm pretty sure we all, at most of our youth could advocate for like what we wanted and what we needed and what we would have loved to have. I know as a young African-American, as a young African-American girl, I was able to see that my experiences were different from my classmates' experiences. I oftentimes went to predominantly white schools, and I was a choice student. I was a student who was able to get in, and I didn't pay as much. I didn't have as many nice things as other students have. My hair was different. I was called dirty because I was brown. And I was called many other things that I'm not going to say on this Zoom call. But I don't want to give power to those things, but also I want to just say that those things are real. And from a very young age, I was aware of my culture, of my identity, of my experiences. And I was able to voice what was happening to me. And I was able to speak on what was happening. But it fell on deaf ears a lot of times, because I feel oftentimes adults don't really value the input and the insight given by young people. It's kind of brushed aside, or it's not given as much, I'm trying to think of the word, it's not given as much merit as an adult when an adult says something, which I think is really unfortunate, because young people are human and have experiences and are able to speak truth to what their experiences are better than an adult can speak truth to what young people's experiences are. My experiences as a young person are completely different from, and I'm sure there are similarities, but they aren't the same as young people's experiences right now. One, it's a completely different generation from mine, but also it's just things change, and we have more technology now than there was when I was young. Laptops they didn't exist. So I, you know, there's like different things that exists now that completely, you know, have a different impact on the childhood and the experience of a child and the experience of a young person. So I think that we want to be able to really advocate for young people, but empower young people and put them in positions where they can advocate for themselves and provide that platform, because who better than them? And then could you repeat the second question?
Oh, yeah. Can you share with us how you see arts and culture, how it plays a role in making the vision of Lit a reality?
I know there's some really fascinating projects Lit has taken on. That's infused. Do you want to speak to maybe your favorite ones? Because there's a lot going on, but are there certain ones that really, you know, get you excited?
arts and culture at Lit. So one of the things that we do as a department for cultural is we focus on really bringing people into the space who have the experience and the connections to the community when it comes to creativity and when it comes to culture, history, acknowledgement of ancestral roots, acknowledgement of the power of, you know, knowing who you are as a people, and representation. So one of the biggest things we always talk about is representation. And like Lit is a Black and Brown organization. So we have a lot of folks from a lot of different cultures who just bring their own experiences. And that's a beautiful thing. It's a difficult thing, but it's also a beautiful thing. You know, it's like there's work to be done for us to be able to understand each other and our different experiences in the world, but how we're also so connected by that. And I think using art and culture really helps show how we're connected. And that's through food, that's through clothing, that's through jewelry, it's through music, dance. There's so many different ways that culturally we're connected to each other, or we are able to just like, we are able to learn how to connect with each other. So that's something that we often use. Some of the projects that we've done that I've really liked. We did a hashtag MKE Movement Art Gallery. That was the Walker's Point Center for the Arts and Public Alice Milwaukee partnership that Lit did. And we had just a bunch of art that's from all different movements spanning across time and even across countries that have affected Black and Brown people, affected gender queer, LGBTQ+, youth, all different types of cultures of people, and just highlighted those experiences and brought many people into a space to really get to learn and appreciate different experiences. And again, like art, no one like was there to like explain, this is my art piece and here's what it means, whatever. But it was like, you could just be in a room full of all these different types of art representing different movements and just feel whatever that brings up for you and really be able to understand and care more about like different social issues. Like this movement, this one issue, maybe the one that you're affected by isn't the only thing going on in the world. It's not the only issue or movement. There's plenty of issues happening all over the world, all at the same time. And it almost makes you kind of feel more connected to people who are from cultures and communities you've never even touched, you know? And so that's something that's really beautiful. And you don't even have to touch or do anything with those communities. You don't have to go colonize them like white people have done. You have to do any of that to actually feel, experience, care, and do something about it, you know? And I think that that's what's really powerful about art, how accessible it is and how it connects people to these different issues.
I visited that exhibit at the Walker's Point Arts Center, and I was struck by how, to your point, the breadth of different movements around the world that it covered. And these were all Black, Brown, Milwaukee artists, I believe, right? Of varying ranges, right? Of age. And I think there's something powerful to have that featured in an art center, right? This is a building for art. We're gonna put this art in the center. And it's talking about conversations and concerns that have been on the margins, right? Mm-hmm. And now it's in the center. And to me, that was a very profound, powerful piece. And stuff. I'm like, oh, I'm so excited to see more of this. Right, I'm sure there's more to come.
Yes, so you have 3 installations this month.
Oh, that's awesome. I want to lift up one other project y'all did, and I just want to share with me what I thought was fascinating was Black Hogwarts. Y'all done? So there's, because one, the social media game is tight because you had like the different houses featured, and you had the different, you know, Lit folks, you know, claiming their house. And just sort of wondering real quick, like, tell me about that project a little bit. And I'll share with you why it resonates with me specifically, but I just would love to hear just like, tell me about like the origin of that, or just sort of like maybe what you've learned by going that route or utilizing pop culture, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a known novel or known series with Black Brown young leaders.
Yeah. So Black Hogwarts was an idea by Dakota Hall, who's our ED. Mm-hmm. And his thought, as far as I understand, his thought process was wanting to do like an intensive summer training program that really helps develop young leaders, Black and Brown leaders in Milwaukee, to get the activism skills and organizing skills they need that would support their campaign work and things like that throughout the school year in MPS. Mm. So he organized that, and I think the first Black Hogwarts took place last summer.
Mm.
In 2019. And then following, was it 2019? No, it had to have been 2018. I think the first Black Hogwarts was in 2018. Yeah. And then it happened last year in person again. And so this year with COVID, we wanted to still engage and interact with our audience and with our organizers online. So we did Black Hogwarts and there were different tracks. So there was a high school track, and the high school track was done in the manner of town halls, where people were able to talk and sit in and hear about what's going on with MPS. Mm. There was a college track for college fellows. We're in different colleges all across the state. So we're in 9 colleges across the state. So now we are a statewide organization. So there's a track for that. There's also an online track for our civics department to teach people about community building and engaging the community, as well as understand government policy and things like that. And then there is a track for, or I should say, there's a track for our Hufflepuff, which was our cultural department. And we did our trainings on artist activism, on cultural organizing, like what is it? Because again, like, people really don't know what is that. And then also we did a self-care one. And now we're revamping to start up our second round of Black Hogwarts this summer. We just finished our first round at the beginning of June, and now we're starting our second round. I'm just gonna say House Hufflepuff is kind of switching it up. So we're gonna be doing it more conversation style. Through a completely different Instagram live interaction. So with different artists throughout the city, different hip hop artists, different visual artists, culture makers, and things like that. So we're like really excited to launch that this month too.
I just wanna, I think what struck me, and again, I'm not like a big Harry Potter guy. Like I know it, my family, like my wife's read all the books. Like I get it, I've seen the movies, I get it, right? Like. I think what really resonates, or what I'm struck by seeing you all utilize that format, is this notion of how do I use, again, an analogy, like an outsider, like Harry Potter, right, to can make change, right? This person literally shows up and is, you know, with co-conspirators, right, can actually, change things and do things and tap into their inner power. Mm-hmm. And it's a white story. Like, that's something that gets me, right? Like, it's to me, it's like, you know, I see in these movies, it's like, they might throw the one Black Brown friend occasionally, right? Or the boyfriend or something.
Occasionally.
Like, right, occasionally. But like for you all to recenter it, you know, I know you have to say Black Hogwarts because it's like, yeah, Hogwarts is white. But like to do that was such, to me, it's such a profound like claiming of like, no way, this transformation story isn't just for those folk. It's for us too. And and it tapped into me, right? Or reminded me, really that narrative is a, like, it is a trope that's common, right? It isn't necessarily belonging to one culture, right? Every culture has a coming of age story, a coming into one's power story, and challenging the hierarchy and things are. And that person like Harry Potter and his teammates saw a world that could be. And to me, that was such a beautiful analogy and just savvy, because people get it. Like, oh, I get, you know, like, again, you know, when you say Black Hogwarts, immediately people are like, all right. Think of all the other youth programming that's out there that's so vague and like, I guess. But you go Black Hogwarts, boom, you're in. And so I just wanted to acknowledge, just as an observer, just like there's a vibe. I was just like, oh, that's good. I just had a vibe, ooh, I dig what they're doing. I love that. And I think it goes back to this notion of just the deep truths that you all touched in. And playful analogy, almost like mixing in some way, like sampling. Like, to me, it's just a clever sample in a way that if and an outsider who doesn't know what you all do, it, oh, Black Hogwarts, all right.
Yeah, you can kind of figure it out.
I'll give you guys 20 bucks. I can get on that. You know, so anyway, I just wanted to
acknowledge it. And that just really resonated with me. And I don't even dig those stories. I just love the utilization of it. As someone who came up, your narrative is just really resonates with me, as I did youth development growing up. And man, God, it was so hard to make curriculum cool. And you all just did it because y'all are very cool already. So I get it. You don't have to act. It's like y'all, and just hearing how you're transforming it through using Instagram, possibly TikToks, right? But you know what I mean? You're going to use platforms that resonate with your core people.
Right.
I just love it. I just want to celebrate that.
Sort of reflecting back to Nyla's earlier point, though, about, you know, the imagination of young people is sort of like unbounded, right? And the olds like us, we're sort of like, well, what are the metrics we're tracking? Like, are all these things, you know, like rolling up to the right outcomes and stuff like that? I mean, it's like, you know, I was sort of reflecting when you were talking, Nyla, about like my youth, and like in my youth, I thought I knew everything. And as I've gotten older, I've gotten actually more about like, God, I don't know anything. And so why not just open it up for everybody, right? Because because everything's uncertain. We can't control anything. So why not just open up the imagination for all folks, which feels so much more freeing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, again, like I just noticed, having worked with youth and still working with youth all the time. Yeah. I mean, I'm still pretty young myself. I'm a millennial. Yeah. But I working with youth, I feel like, wow, like this, I used to be where you all are. You all keep me young.
Yeah.
And I honestly feel like the more time I spend around young people, the easier it is for me to come up with new ideas or things that I haven't thought of before, thinking of things in a completely different way. And the less time I spend around youth, I feel I can feel that leave me, you know, that desire and that risk-taking thought process, this kind of isn't as strong when I'm not spending as much time with young people. So I think young people, I think every company, every organization should hire young people, not even just, I mean, young people like in their 20s, but also young people who are in high school, and like pay them as interns to really just kind of counsel them and help them think outside the box and remember that it's okay to take those kinds of risks, because taking risks is what's going to really actually make you be able to move bounds forward. So I just think that's powerful.
And also listen deeply when they ask really good questions, right?
Yes.
Because they're going to ask these obvious questions that everyone's ignoring in real time. Like, nobody wants to name the elephant in the room, but the young person's going to be like, wait, what's up with this? And yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a good question. See, because we all have mortgages we're trying to pay, and nobody wants to ask that question because I might not be able to pay my mortgage. Right. But that's what a young person does, right? Is just make that, hey, what's up with this? I don't get that at all, right?
Like, right.
Yeah, right.
Right. Yeah.
Nyla, you are a cultural organizer, which means you listen deeply to culture and you observe culture and see it, especially culture that's not maybe center, right? Or not maybe seen. And so how would you describe Milwaukee's culture? And moreover, what do you wish more people knew that they don't get to be where, you know, maybe in the rooms you get to be in or hear the leaders you get to witness?
So one thing I notice is Milwaukee community-wise is always about this work, ready to go, willing to put in the time, even just like looking at the history of Milwaukee and Milwaukee's young people, especially with the NAACP Youth Council back a little over 50 years ago now, with the housing march, the Fair Housing March that took place for marching for 201 nights straight. I think being able to just see that our community has always been about putting in the work, has always put culture at the forefront. And the sad part is Milwaukee and like people in positions of power, like the government of Milwaukee, Common Council of Milwaukee, and then just as well as the arts and cultural organizations in Milwaukee don't center culture, don't center the things that the community values. I think that's one of the biggest issues. I mean, there's so many places downtown that just do not center or prioritize or even speak up in opposition to the harm that's being done towards Black and Brown people in the community. And the sad part is there's Black and Brown creatives and culture makers in those same spaces, and those organizations still aren't speaking up. So it's like, there are, like, I know there's a protest coming up on the 18th of July, I think it is, regarding Black musicians and string players, and how there's the Milwaukee Orchestra, and like there's Marcus Center for the Performing Arts, and there's so many other organizations downtown that, you know, underpay and, you know, work with directly these musicians, these dancers and stuff like that, but have yet to have made a statement or speak out or support their creatives of color, their Black creatives. And then same with, like, there's folks who are working in those organizations. And when COVID happened, those folks who worked on like diversity committees and who worked on making sure that Black and Brown people were centered in those organizations and given opportunities were the first to get let go. And so I think Milwaukee, the community, is there's a huge gap between the community and between those in power who are saying they have opportunities, those who work in culture and art organizations, and those who have decision-making power in government. I think there's a huge gap between them. I think that our Milwaukee's art scene is still very white. It's still very masculine. It's still very exclusive. It's still very heterosexual. It's still very, it's just missing so many things. It's still very cisgendered. We don't really highlight or focus on the community, like who is actually providing new creative ideas, who is actually has a different cultural perspective, background, experience than the cis heterosexual white man. And I think that that's what's really disappointing about that Milwaukee just doesn't want to, from the higher up going, like on the way, like moving down the power ladder, just does not want to share and highlight and what Milwaukee actually represents, because Milwaukee is mostly people of color. So the fact that that's not the representation of our arts and culture scene is how I know that there's a problem. And there's not any lack of culture and art in the community. So it's just a matter of when a Black person creates art, it's Black art. But when a white person creates art, it's fine art. And it's given a different platform. It's advocated for. It's given space in different museums and galleries. And it's paid more money to be sold and to be shown off. Whereas it's not. There's like a very specific, almost like niche for artists who don't do, who aren't white. And I think that that's what's something that's really problematic, that, you know, the community of artists and creatives have been calling out Milwaukee's art and culture scene because of that, and rightfully so. And I think that it's got to change. So that's something that's something I feel about Milwaukee's cultural scene right now. There's so much culture. We are booming, but the city's just, that we're gonna come whether they're ready for it or not. Like we are going to put our stuff in the forefront, and it's about time that the city really catches on.
So you've it feels like you've already foreshadowed this, but want to formally ask, because we ask every guest, it sounds like you've got a very compelling platform to be, you know, the czar of arts and culture, or the person who could move policy, and so maybe you could choose to summarize it, but you only get to be there for 2 minutes. So that's a limitation that we have on this podcast. It only lasts for 2 minutes. So Naila, if or maybe there's things you haven't spoken to yet you want to speak to, what would you advocate for, or what are policies you would pass? Again, I heard you talk about how do you have power sharing, how do you actually invest directly into communities and artists of communities, etc. You could dig into that, or there are other elements of like, well, actually, how about you try this? What would you respond to that? That would make Milwaukee this vibrant place that we already know it is, it can be.
So I honestly think that the community just needs more dollars. I think the dollars should go to the community to create our own infrastructure, our own art and cultural organizations. I think it takes way more, I'm an abolitionist at heart. I think it takes way more work, time, and energy on those who have been harmed to try to reform a broken system. So I think it makes more sense to really allocate and have those funds go towards people who already have a goal, a vision, a dream, but just don't have the funds to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And that definitely is the community on the north side of Milwaukee and the community on the south side of Milwaukee. There's so many people who are creative, who have plenty of cultural experience to share, and are able to envision what they want to see. So I think the most powerful thing we can do is advocate more funding to arts. So like we could, you know, completely abolish the police and like give that money to arts and to healthcare and things like that. Mm-hmm. But then also make sure that money isn't going towards any white led art institutions. Mm-hmm. It should be going towards art institutions and culture institutions, which are led by the, you know, people from those actual cultures and mm-hmm. people who are, you know, people of color, people who are queer identifying and stuff like that. I think that that is the most radical thing we could do to really support all of our people and all of the creatives and culture makers in the city. I don't think they need us to tell them what to do. I don't think they need us to get a grant and be like, we need someone to do this project. I don't think that's necessary. I think we would be on a completely different level right now if we just gave them the money and was like, you know, create, be the creator, be a god, do it.
Because they full circle, we come back full circle, right? The art of it. And I appreciate it. Thanks for your leadership, a glorious reign of it, even though it ended right now. I think David and I and Imagine is committed to carry on the legacy of that, which is bringing more into the center. So it isn't just when we think of Milwaukee, it isn't one or two neighborhoods that tend to always get the attention and support, but rather it's all of Milwaukee more. And that how is the joyful abundance that is already happening? How does it get more to the center? How does it get lifted and supported to do what it needs to do, what it already knows, what it can do? That's what.
You know, I'm sort of reflecting on that thought about just giving folks money, right? And just I'm reminded of the conversation we had as we were building the MKE Artist Relief Fund, and there's like 2 minutes of discussion of like, is there going to be some sort of eligibility, and whether or not we're going to prioritize BIPOC creators and artists? And so the eligibility pieces are like, nope, we're just going to give people money. They're not going to have to report back, and then on the BIPOC priority, we're like, yep, that's basically, we're going to prioritize Black and Brown artists and creators in our city. And I think to your point, right, people know what to do with money. And when they need it, you know, it was not within our interest to dictate any of that, right? Just like, you guys are creative and go make it happen.
Right. And it was compelling because we targeted 50K, ended up close to 200K. So that wasn't amazing. A hang up for people either, right? It wasn't like, well, I got to know where this is going. They only got to pay for food, right? Like, no, it's like, let them do what they got to do, right? And it's like, okay, I get that, right? And we did get a few pushback on like, why are you doing that? And, you know, all we had to do is just kind of list sort of like, you know, what do you got against this? You know, like right. And again, it's one of those things, all you put it back on them and allow people to do their own work. They kind of go, oh, okay.
Right.
You know, they get it. Right. So.
Right. Cause I think one of the biggest things that I see happening often is first of all, thank you all for letting me review like grants for that. That was awesome.
Oh yeah.
I absolutely love that.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. We didn't so thank excited. You. We were like, we're talking about how great it was. And like, meanwhile, she's like, I was a great reviewer.
Did it for a few weeks.
I know. Like
you helped, right? I mean,
you helped big time. Oh my gosh. Folks who helped there's us no way we're going to do intake of all those apps. Right. Yeah. Anyways, thank you.
Oh, God. You fished for that. I was so happy to do it. No, I was so happy to do it. Like, I was just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they asked me. Yes, I'd love to.
Oh my gosh.
Like, artists deserve money. And and that's one of my biggest things with grants, you know, like, you have to specify each line item, like, what is the money going towards?
Yeah.
And a lot of times when you do art projects and it's based off a grant, a lot of times the funds that because the grant is written by the organizers or the fundraisers, the artist doesn't have the funds for the actual project that they need. They're like, actually, you're going to need $10,000 for this installation just for the supplies for the installation.
Yeah.
And that has nothing to do with like any of the other items that, you know, that $10,000 grant is not going to cover the mural because, you know, whatever. And it's just like, grants make me cringe when they're art related because they're so limiting.
Yeah.
And I was like, if they just were appointed the decision making and appointed the funds, nothing else to worry about.
Well, that mimics what you just said. It's like, trust people to do what they do. And if we really believe in them and we see mm-hmm. their giftedness and their fullness, they're going to do it. Why wouldn't they not? Right. And it's really fascinating. Even we had micro moments of, is this going to be okay? And for me, that's just shedding what you just talked about of these other institutions that I've lived in and worked in and tried to unpack and I let go. And I'll say thanks again for being part of that. Because again, for us, it was just so important to have everyone involved at every step of the way, right? Having community involved, artist community themselves, you know, verifying and making sure this is spot on. Thanks so much for hanging with us. Naila, where can they find you? Either you or Lit. This plug time, plug it away. Time. How can they find you after this piece?
So I really love Instagram. So you can find me on Instagram. My creative platform Instagram is at VibrancyMKE. So that's at VYBRANCYMKE. Mm-hmm. And I also am on Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn as Naila Johnson. And then I also, you can find me at Lit. Right now we're working remotely, but my email is my first name, NAILAH at litmke.org.
And I went all this time without referencing the fact they're also public allies.
Did it again.
Well. Yes, so there it is. There it is. David now gets to be left out. David gets to be excluded and left out. Sorry, David, it's not osmosis. Just because you've been in all these conversations with alum, you don't get to be one. Sorry, you got to put in the time. 1,700 hours, 10 months. You got to put in the time.
If there was a new alumni coordinator or director at Public Allies, I might petition that person.
Naila, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you all so much.
Thanks for being such an amazing leader and for doing the work.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is great.
Thank you all. Thank you so much. People,
loudest one voice. We will rejoice. Really exciting conversation. I think what is so exciting about about having guests like Naila on is that she's able to provide, I think, just some really great perspectives from voices that we typically just don't hear around the office a lot. And I think that's just really, really powerful. And I think, you know, the thing that I'm taking away from this is, and sort of based on our, also sort of reflecting back to the beginning conversation that we had leading into the interview, is how just important it is to be seen, right? This idea of like including folks in a city's story, culture, art, is empowering. Is just that simple act, right, of being seen as empowering. Mm.
It's you know, when I think about the art of cultural organizing, there's an art of what she does, because you have to listen, you have to weave these stories together, you amplify it back, and if it resonates with people, that means it's true, it was there. It's a beautiful example of, again, if one believes that organizing itself is an art, it's like art uncovers truth and it resonates with people. And that's why people like they can't name it, right? They can't put words on it, but it's there. Like it stops them. It captures their imagination. And I think that's what really great organizing does. It does those things because it's true, right? It's valid. And it brought forth something that wasn't there before. That didn't maybe have language before, but it's so true. And that's why it is. I'm also thinking, you know, to channel into my connected, I forget, I think it's a lesser strength of mine, but it's not number four. But, you know, I talked about Northwestern, right? Because that was kind of where I got my early story, you know, the key stories in my life where I sort of confronted some truths. I thought of the Northwestern motto, Quacunque sunt vera, right? At the risk of like making this like a, I don't know, fundraiser for Northwestern. It isn't. But the phrase goes, finally, it's from the New Testament book of Philippians. And it's the quote means, you know, finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. And I couldn't, maybe it's serendipity, you know, timing with the story I shared earlier. But when I think about the work that Lit does, I think it's those finding those things in the community, finding those things in Black, Brown, young people in Milwaukee for I think for many years haven't been seen in that way. And they see them in that way.
I think utilizing culture as a way to shift narratives is just it's an incredibly powerful tool, and the work that they're doing, obviously, I think they're clearly ahead of the game.
You know who else is ahead of the game?
Our listeners.
Thanks for listening to another edition of the Imagine MKE Pod, and thanks for dealing with that awful segue to the end. But be sure to rate us. You should rate us, because if you're listening, that means you like us. But we want more people to like us, because they get to hear cool things like Naila and the work of Lit, and the more guests we have upcoming to learn about how awesome and abundant Milwaukee is with arts and culture. And you could also email us at pod@imaginemke.org if you have other leads or ideas of who we should be highlighting with regards to the joyful abundance of the city.
Hit us up on Twitter and Instagram at @imagine_MKE or Facebook at @imaginemke. Make sure to mention the pod on social media, react to it, or cries of shock and outrage at hashtag it at #imaginaryfriend. And make sure you listen to MKE Arts Forward, our podcast that's hosted by Lindsay Sheridan, Director of Marketing and PR. This last week, she had Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the show.
Was it the Supreme Court justice?
You're gonna have to tune in to find out. And what's really exciting is that they talk about advancing social justice through activism and eight-part harmonies, which sort of pairs kind of nicely with this show. And if you do listen, and it is the actual Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you will be shocked to know that she sings in eight-part harmonies by herself.
Until then, we'll let you solve that mystery. Talk to you next week. Bye.